this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silica Cast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, July 19th, 2015, and this is show number 532. This week's show is going to be formatted a little bit differently. I got a couple of stories for you. Then Bart is going to join us, but just for talking about security with us. He's going to talk about the hackers getting hacked this week. He's going to give us some security light and important security news. Then for Chit Chat Across the Pond, we'll be joined by Serenity Caldwell from iMore. Next week, Bart will be back to join us along with Steve Sheridan for a special episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond. Before I forget, next week's live show will be on Saturday, not Sunday, at 3 p.m. Pacific time. That's 3 p.m., not 5 p.m., so it's going to be 3 p.m. on Saturday. I'm doing it for Nuris because that's the day she wants it. Actually, that's the time she wants it. I'm not doing it on Sunday because I'm going on vacation for a week. I know, I can hear you right now. What's vacation when you're retired? Or, didn't you just get back from India? Well, both those things are true, but I'm not going to be around on Sunday, so I'm not going to do the show on Sunday. Also, the following week, Alistair Jenks will be doing the show. That's a show that airs on August 2nd, so there will be no live show on August 2nd. If you've been meaning to send in a recording for the show sometime around now, dust off that microphone and send it in. You can send them to me, and I'll forward them on to Alistair for inclusion in the show. It really does help the guest host when you guys send in your recordings, so get one out, get a recording out there for them. By the way, if you buy the NoSilicast app, you'll get notifications of these changes. You'll be able to see when the new live show times are, and you'll never miss a show again. Well, this week I was on a couple of shows. First, I was on the SMR podcast on episode number 262 entitled Little Community. Rob was out, so I joined Rod Simmons and Chris Ashley, and we had such a blast. I mean, the time flew by. If you haven't heard the show before, go check it out. It is such a great geek time. On Thursday, I was on the Daily Tech News Show, episode number 2538, entitled Amazon is Past Its Prime Day. Tom and I talked about whether the desktop office suite is dead, so go check that out. All right, let's get started into the main part of the show. Dave Hamilton of the Mac Geek Gab was talking about how his iPhone misbehaved badly when he first installed iOS 8.4. He said that the battery was draining even while on the charger. While this was interesting, I didn't worry about it too much because I'd been running 8.4 for a while and my battery was just fine. Until a couple of days ago when it started losing charge like it had a hole in it. I plugged it into the wall charger and not only did it not gain charge, it got really, really hot too. I gave it a timeout, shut it down all the way and restarted it, and that did not fix the problem. I charged it overnight and in the morning it seemed like it was fine. It was charged 100%. But then at 10:30 after my morning run, I got the 20% battery warning. Well, that's not good. David said that since he was leaving on vacation the day he installed 8.4, he had no time to fool around with things, so he simply ran a backup and did a restore, and all was well. Cool. I decided I'd just do that too. Now, I do keep iCloud backups turned on, but I hesitate to use them. I mean, why sit around waiting for iCloud when I can do a backup right to iTunes the old-fashioned way? It's got to be faster, right? I ran the backup to iTunes using a wire and everything, and then I told iTunes to do the restore. It asked me, say, 12 different times, are you sure you want to erase everything on your phone? Well, of course I'm sure. After the phone was completely erased, I told it to restore from the backup. My first inclination that something was awry was that it said my last backup was on July 6th, and it was July 14th when I did that. I don't think that was part of the problems I ended up having, though. I figured it wasn't that big of a deal if I got a backup from the 6th anyway, because my photos are protected, my email's in the cloud. What could I need so badly that I did between the 6th and the 14th? For some reason, the restore took hours to complete. It actually seemed to be writing the code by hand for every app it was putting back on the phone, rather than just copying over USB. It finally finished, but I wasn't done yet. The phone had to go through a whole bunch of initial setup stuff. I had to tell it the network, give it a passcode, tell it no to restoring passwords for me in the iCloud keychain because I don't like to use that, and I even had to retrain it to do my fingerprints. Then I had to repair it with my Apple Watch. I was excited because on the first day it didn't work right when I did the pairing with the Apple Watch, and I didn't get to scan that psychedelic swirly image that comes up on the watch like all the cool kids did to perform their pairing. This time, that worked, and all that was left to my phone was to tell it to use my credit card for Apple Pay again. And then I noticed something horrible. 100% of my activity data was gone from the Apple Watch. I couldn't believe it. I've been exercising like a maniac since May 24th, and all of that lovely data was gone. And you know how I love data, right? I was distraught, to say the least. I sent a message to Dave Hamilton, and he didn't make it much better when he so helpfully said, "Allison, the good news is that regardless of what your iPhone says, you actually did all that activity, you know." Clearly, he does not understand me. Well, as one does, I started hunting on the web for a solution. I was unwilling to give up on all that juicy data I had collected. Turns out there's a good reason that Apple did not keep this data for me. Remember how they keep saying they're committed to keeping our private data private? And, you know, it turns out they're especially serious about protecting our health data, as well they should, and activity data is considered health data. Because I ran a backup on my computer, and I had not chosen to have encrypted backups, Apple did not include my sensitive health data. The good news is that if you have an iCloud backup, Apple encrypts it so your iCloud backup does include your health data. Took a look at my iPhone, and I realized I had an iCloud backup from that very morning right after my run. I went through the entire rigmarole of restoring from a backup again. While the backup was coming back down from the cloud, I decided to stop watching the phone like I had been doing obsessively pretty much all day, and I went for an untethered walk with my dog. It was a very odd experience to have no podcast in my ears and just, you know, enjoy the outdoor surroundings. Heck, I even talked to a couple of people on my walk. I wouldn't recommend this for the long term, of course, but it was an interesting experience nonetheless. When I got home, to my great delight, all of that luscious activity data came streaming back into my iPhone. I was delighted. The only problem was it meant I had to repair my watch to my phone, and I lost that 3-mile walk I'd done without my phone while waiting for the restore of my data. I decided I could live with that. At least I have all my other data. But it does mean that my phone will not send me a delightful message telling me I had a perfect week this week. I really like that little message. The bottom line is I think Apple really is protecting our data the way they say they are. I think it would have been a tad less distressing for me as a user if when I started the tethered backup, they'd explained to me that my activity data and other private data would not be backed up because I wasn't doing an encrypted backup. I did, of course, send a strongly worded note to apple.com/feedback with that suggestion. My housekeeper, Rocio, has been working us for years. This summer, her soon-to-be 13-year-old son has nothing to do, so she's dragging the poor kid along to work so that he doesn't sit home playing video games all day or get into some kind of mischief. I think Rocio is brilliant to do this because she's drilling into his head that if he doesn't want to do a job like this for the rest of his life, he better do well in school. You can imagine, of course, that as a 13-year-old, he's riveted to her every word and thinks she's as brilliant as I do, right? Well, I started thinking, what if I could give this kid some stuff to do that stimulated his mind while she was working? Maybe I could get him interested in my favorite subjects, science and math. Now, he may not be interested in these subjects, and I may have no effect on him, but what if he took a liking to it and had a real aptitude? I figured there was no harm in trying, so I asked his mom, and she readily and very enthusiastically agreed to this idea. You heard me talk last week about Little Bits, the hardware modules that a kid can stick together with magnets to do wonderful, magical things. I sat down with him last Thursday and started to walk him through how to play with them. He's a really quiet, shy kid and didn't say much, but I started to see a flicker of interest in his eyes. I have no idea, by the way, whether this kid is the next Richard Feynman or has subpar intelligence, but I figured, why not assume that he's brilliant until otherwise notified? In my opinion, with children, if you set the bar low for them, they will gladly meet those low expectations. If you set the expectations high, they often meet those as well. We put an LED up against a light sensor and got it to turn a motor. We connected a speaker to my cell phone and added power and heard the sound. We used a microphone connected to the speaker and we heard our words come out. He was starting to have some fun. Based on this theory of mine, I started saying things like, "I knew a kid as smart as you would love this stuff, and you really have a talent for this. Most kids aren't as good at this when they start." The smiles from him got bigger and bigger as we did more experiments. Now, I mostly guided him through this first effort, but he started to take baby steps on his own with it. I called his mother over and said, "Look what he made," and convinced him to tell his mother what he had created. And that worked really, really well. But a day later, I got the most awesome text message from his mom, Rocio. She wrote, "OMG, thank you very much," in giant capital letters, "for spending some of your time teaching my son. We were at my mom's house and he was telling my family what he learned. He is really excited. I could see in his face that he really liked it. When we left your house, he asked me right away if he could come next week." Well, I gotta tell you, I am still grinning ear to ear about getting that message. But this week I had to keep his interest level up, right? I can't just drop him now. This week, I decided to go with something to get his hands a little dirtier. I decided to teach him how to make a magnet out of some wire, a battery, and a nail. If you never got to do this yourself, it's a lot of fun. You should try it. You take a very thin wire, the kind with shielding on it, not bare wire, and you wrap it around a steel nail. A whole lot of wraps, like 50 wraps around the steel nail. Now, the nail must be steel because it must have iron in it, or the experiment isn't going to work. Then you strip the ends of the wire back a bit and hold them onto the opposite ends of a AA battery. The tip of the nail will be magnetic. If you search the internet for wire, nail, battery experiment, you'll find tons of tutorials online showing how to do this. Michael Faraday in the 1820s suggested the connection between electricity and magnetism, now the field called electromagnetism, and is credited with the practical usage of these tools. I explained this to the young man and then showed him my favorite use of electromagnetism. Turns out that not only does flowing electricity through a wire, a coiled wire, induce a magnetic field, you can do the reverse as well. If you put a bar magnet inside a coil of wire, you know, not touching the coil of water, but floating in the middle of it, and you send an electrical current through the wire, you can make the magnet move. I took him over to our stereo speaker and pulled the protective cover off to show him the real face of the speaker, the paper face. I explained that as the stereo pumped electricity into the speaker, it was moving a magnet in and out that moved the paper face of the speaker, which in turn moved the air to make the sound in his ears. Now, I'm not sure he followed all of this explanation, but my father always said to think of teaching children as being like trying to pour a bucket of water into the neck of a wine bottle. Not everything's going to get in, but pour enough and enough times, some of it's going to get in. I think my favorite part of the second session was when we'd exhausted the fun of the wire magnet and he asked if he could play with the little bits again. I didn't help him at all this time. I just played on my laptop in the same room with him, and then I heard the most wonderful words come out of his mouth. He said, "I wonder what would happen if..." You know, I almost cried with joy. It was just that spark, that light was on. He was 100% bought in. He played with it for another half hour, and he kept making up his own experiments, many of which failed, but by the way, I never told him they wouldn't work, and over again, he said those joyous words, "I wonder what would happen if." I'm a member of a local user group in town, but I don't attend those meetings. I do read people's questions that they send in email, though, mostly because I just enjoy the heck out of knowing the answer to a problem and helping someone along the way. This week, a gentleman named Michael was complaining about Apple Photos and how he had to use it and how he couldn't use iPhoto anymore. I explained in one response that iPhoto is still there and you can still use it. He explained back that his workflow has been stolen by Photos, though, because Photos keeps opening. I suspected the problem was that his default setting was to open Photos when inserting his memory card, camera, or phone. I explained that simply changing the behavior over an image capture would fix the problem. He wrote back that it didn't work. I finally did what I should have done in the first place. I whipped open Clarify, inserted a memory card, opened Image Capture, took three screenshots, put an arrow pointing to the upwards-facing teeny-tiny disclosure triangle that lets you see the control of what happens when you insert a device, and I showed him that you could indeed still choose iPhoto to open. I put a couple of words in to explain what you have that you do have to insert the something into the device enabled in order to get access to these controls. Now, this wasn't a masterpiece I really needed to post online, so I simply went to Edit and chose Copy Document to Clipboard from within Clarify. I chose Text and Images and then pasted it into the email and hit Send. This took far less time than I'd spent with Michael going back and forth in Words. I wanted to read you what he wrote back. "Ah, thank you, Allison. Yes, I did try the image capture thing in response to your first email, but I think I may not have had the SD card plugged in at the time, and perhaps it sets the options per device. Either way, your illustrations were perfect. Thank you. How wonderfully kind of you. Your patience penetrated my frustration. You're awesome. Have I said thank you enough? Just in case, thank you again." Okay, how's that for a good testimonial? He also asked me, he said, "You know, I use Snagit to help other people. What tool did you use?" You can bet I told him that it was Clarify. Like I said, if this isn't a good enough tutorial, I don't know what's ever going to get you to go over to clarify-it.com and download the free trial for Mac or Windows or both. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's not time for Chit Chat Across the Pond, but it is time for Security Medium with Bart Bouchatz. How are you doing today, Bart?
I am doing just fine, Allison. So it's medium and light, but not a Chit Chat Across the Pond.
Right. Now, that doesn't mean you're not getting a chit-chat across the pond. As I have probably already mentioned in the show, we have Serenity Caldwell for chit-chat across the pond this week. It's getting all mixed up. We're just crazy now with this schedule.
Yeah, myself and Steve are working on something cool for next week.
Yes.
But I had a massive amount of security stuff, and I was like, if I put that off till next week, poor Steve isn't going to get to talk about any cool stuff because we're just going to spend our whole time on security.
All right, well, we better kick into it. Security Medium is where we're starting.
We are indeed. So When the Hackers Get Hacked is the title I've given this. So There has been, it's like one story with just like 100 meta stories coming out of it. But there is an Italian company called Hacking Team. And as their name suggests, they are professional hackers. And they are employed by people like the Italian government, the American government, the Egyptian government, the Russian government, lots and lots of different governments.
To do vulnerability testing kind of stuff?
Oh, no, they sell hacking kits. It's not even vulnerability testing. They sell you the ability to hack people.
Oh, okay.
So, right. It's a whole, we've gone beyond gray. You know, this is not this tool might be used for vulnerability testing, wink, wink. We're clean into, it is a hacking toolkit. So on the 6th of July, the news broke that this company had been infiltrated and 400 gigabytes of data had been exfiltrated from their network. Now, that's a lot of data. So it took a while for that to be digested. And in fact, that process is still ongoing. So probably the most important link in the show notes is there's Ars Technica do this thing where they make a series sometimes. And it's basically, think of it like an RSS feed for only stuff relating to a particular bigger story. So in this case, there's a link in the show notes to a page on which will appear links to all the Ars Technica news stories about this bigger story, if that makes
sense. Okay. Yeah.
Because it just keeps coming. It's going to take ages for them to get through all of those emails and all of that files and basically everything that has been exfiltrated from this company. But the fallout from it sort of falls into two categories. There's a practical category, and there's a sort of a more philosophical, political, moral question out of the whole thing. So I've split the story into those two halves so that we can get the nuts and bolts stuff easily done. So first off, these people are selling the ability to hack people, and the way they can do that is they have exploits no one else knows about that they use to do that hacking. In other words, they have a cache of zero-day exploits.
So instead of offering them to the company and getting bounties, they've been using them.
Right. So they offer a service, which basically says, they sort of turned the software as a service. Right. And they're using these 0 days to fulfill the promises. So, we'll get you onto those machines and then you can deploy whatever your malware is or whatever your listening device is. Or you can do whatever you want. We'll get you in. And the way they get you in is through 0 days. So they obviously have a cache of 0 days. We know that they buy those 0 days of security research. They found a receipt for $45,000 to a Russian chap for finding a flash 0 day. So that's how these people work. So unsurprisingly, in that 400 gigs of data were some 0 day exploits. And once they were, of course, released, that became it was a problem anyway, but now we know it was a problem. So there have been 3 0 days in flash to come out of this breach. And Adobe fixed those 3 vulnerabilities in 2 updates. So one of them came out really, really quickly, and that was patched very quickly by Adobe. And then a few days later, digging through more of the 400 gigs, another 2 Adobe Flash 0 days were found. So Adobe put out one more patch to fix both of those. So there's 2 new Adobe patches in the last week or two.
So it's a good thing that the hacking team got hacked because Adobe found out about this 0 day flaw and then patched it.
Yes, these 3 0-day flaws and then patched twice, yes.
Okay.
It wasn't just Adobe, there was also a 0-day in Internet Explorer 11, which was patched by Microsoft.
Okay.
So the most practical thing that everyone has to do is to update their Flash/IE11, depending on which you have, if any. A side effect of this that's still in the realm of not political, but is less concrete, is the fact that this has reignited discussion within our community about Flash. And that discussion has taken a few forms. You have, I think it was the new chief security officer of Facebook basically said, I think all of the browser manufacturers need to agree a date, and on that date they will all kill Flash. In other words, give Flash an end of life. We are removing Flash on this date in this year, and it could be a year and a half from now, whatever, to give people time to prepare. But they said that the only way Flash is going to go away is if someone draws a line in the sand and says, this is it. After this date, no more Flash. I doubt it'll happen, but it's a nice idea. Also, a manufacturer of Linux PCs. They're a company called System 76 that make Ubuntu PCs. They have said that we're just not putting Flash in our PCs anymore.
Huh.
So that's
progress. Why do you think that Adobe wouldn't do it?
Adobe aren't going to kill their own product, so it would have to be Firefox, Chrome, Apple, and Microsoft agreeing to do it.
Well, right?
They could, but are their relationships with Adobe such that they would not? Do Microsoft want to antagonize Adobe? Do Apple want to antagonize Adobe? Apple in particular have recently redeveloped links with Adobe after Steve Jobs severed them. Do Apple want to do that? You know, so it's difficult to get those four browser manufacturers. Like, just look at how long HTML5 took to specify.
Right.
And that tells you how good communication between browser manufacturers is. Like, it does happen, but it's not speedy. So maybe it's a sensible thing to call for. I just don't see it happening.
Yeah.
There has also been, of course, a spate of articles about people saying, well, I haven't had Flash on my computer for a year. And you know something? It's absolutely fine. Take the plunge, people. Seriously, the pool is just fine. And then
I keep trying to keep it off. And it seems to come back. I mean, I'm sure it's some action I'm taking where, you know, I go someplace and I'm like, ah. But I keep swearing I don't have it. And then I look and it's back.
Well, I have found that at home I do have it, but at work I don't, because I actually never find myself needing it in a work context.
Okay.
So it's more for entertainment stuff that you know, for silly sites that you do for fun rather than because you need to.
Yeah.
Which I guess for home users means they probably still need Flash. So a good halfway house is to install Chrome. And that way you have a very locked down version of Flash that updates itself automatically. And just don't install the plugin into your other browsers. That's an approach that works well for some people. And as I say, in work, I just don't have Flash. And it's working for me in that context, but at home I do.
Yeah.
Speaking of Chrome being better in this regard, something else that was released as news, and maybe the timing isn't coincidental, but Adobe have said that actually we've been working behind the scenes with the zero-day team in Google for quite some time now on ways of hardening Flash. Because what's basically been discovered, the amount of Flash 0 days is just not funny. Flash has a really soft underbelly and it's easy to exploit. And so the obvious answer to that is either kill the product or harden the product. And they have been working on ways of hardening it. And so today, this minute in time, the version of Flash that is in Chrome is actually more hardened than the version of Flash in other browsers, because it already has one of these two future features that are coming later this summer.
Oh.
So they're doing something called heap partitioning, which is basically a way of laying out memory in such a way that it becomes much harder for buffer overflows to give attackers a leg up, and also for use after free exploits to give attackers a leg up. And basically all of the 0 days we've seen this year so far have been either use after free or a buffer overflow. So if you make those harder to turn into an actual exploit, yeah, okay, there's still buffer overflows in the code, but if you can't use them to attack the product, that's still a great step forward. So Chrome has it already, and we're all getting it in August for other browsers. So that's good.
Well, that's an interesting separate option that never occurred to me, was do some serious redesign to make this not so easy to exploit.
Yeah. And I mean, you know,
make it not crappy.
There's a lot of work to do, but this is a very practical step, because if, again, you look at the common things that all the exploits have, and this is what they're doing. So, okay, how do we make this not work? And so it's a very good response. And also, a lot of the attacks have used something called vector objects within Flash. And so they're also hardening vector objects as a second mitigation against exploitation. So those two concrete things are being done to make Flash harder to break. So that's also good.
So this is a good news day.
In many ways it is, to be honest. Now, from a political point of view, it's good news in the sense that we now know more. So this is not on the same scale as Snowden, obviously, but it's a similar sort of thing. We have known that there are these security contractors who are doing something for our governments, because we can see in the budgets that they're being paid money, but we're not being told what they're doing because it's all secret, secret, secret. Now we know, because we have basically just seen 400 gigs worth of information on what it is that these companies do. So the first thing is, this company is not some sort of one-off, right? This is not the only contractor doing this kind of thing. This is one of many. And so we just have a random snapshot into this industry. And that then allows us to ask political questions. Is it appropriate that our governments are giving money to a company who are selling these kind of tools to countries like Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Russia, Egypt? These are not necessarily governments whom we agree with. Some of them are oppressive regimes. So by paying these companies or allowing these companies to sell this stuff to us and to them, there are ethical issues there. There's also the fact that these companies were paying them to have 0 days that they are then keeping secret, which means that we're basically paying them to make every citizen less secure. And is that something our government should be doing?
So let's take a contrary point of view. If all the countries with oppressive regimes had these tools, wouldn't you also want your government to have these tools?
Or would it? Yeah, that's one way to look at it. But the thing with the 0 days is there has been an argument for a long time that actually Western governments should be buying these 0 days, responsibly disclosing them and getting them fixed. Because right now, the black market.
Who would sell them to you a second time if you did that?
It's not about a second time, right? So you go onto the same marketplace where you're buying them now and keeping them secret, and you pay the same money, but you don't keep them secret.
Right, but so they don't know who's buying them, probably, or do they?
Well, we know who's buying them. These companies are buying them, and they're buying them off security researchers.
No. And but I'm saying,
black market.
U.S. government representative Bob goes in and buys a 0 day exploit and then discloses it responsibly.
Mm-hmm.
I would suggest that Bob wouldn't be allowed to get another 0 day to expose it.
Depends on how you do it.
Yeah. I'm sure you could easily anonymously do it.
Right. Yeah, but
I'm sure they have that option, right? Pay in Bitcoin or something.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are ways of doing it. So there are basically there's a lot of stuff being done on our behalf that we haven't known about, and now we know about it, and we may decide we think it's perfectly fine, or we may decide we don't agree with it, but either way we know more now. So we can have a discussion about it, which we couldn't have last week. Yeah. So that is, I don't know what that is, but that is something that is significant. Some of the highlights. So there's, as I say, that link to the stream will give you all of the news stories, but just some stuff to notice. So the hacking team appear to have broken EU laws because you're not allowed to export these kind of hacking tools to Russia from Europe, according to our laws. But it seems like they did. So that's,
is the hacking team in Europe?
Yes, they're an Italian company.
Oh, okay.
So they should be following EU law.
All right.
They used BGP, they used a hack of the Border Gateway Protocol, the routing algorithm of the internet, to steal IP addresses they had no right to.
Okay.
That's interesting. They also say that what we have now is only a fraction of what they actually have. So as much as we see they can do, they actually can do more, or at least they say they can. That may be a PR stunt so they don't go out of business. Take that one with a grain of salt. And also they have been working on undermining Bitcoin secrecy. So in other words, tying those random numbers to real people.
Oh, interesting.
And removing the cloak. Yes, and apparently a lot of repressive regimes are very interested in de-anonymizing Bitcoin. Very interested. Can't imagine
why. Great. So
as I say, I'm not making any statements on whether this is good or bad. I'm just saying that we now know more, therefore we can have a debate.
Do we also know that they're, like you, I think you implied, or at least I inferred from what you said, that hacking team is not the only company doing this?
Oh, God, yeah. There is a whole industry of these security companies, these contracts.
So the fact that this has been exploited and maybe even would be shut down over time because some of the stuff they're doing is illegal in Europe doesn't mean that any of this stops.
Right, exactly. This doesn't give us a way of ending anything. This just gives us the ability to have a discussion and to decide whether we want to, you know, pressure our Congress critters to change things.
Mm-hmm.
This is purely informational. This was happening. This will probably continue to happen. But now we know it's happening. And the question is, what do we do with that information? What do we decide that means for us? So it's interesting in exactly the same way the Snowden revelations are interesting. It doesn't change anything, and yet it changes everything.
Interesting.
So that's kind of all I had on that. So unless there's something else you want to bring up, I think that sort of covers the...
No, that was pretty interesting. It's not as depressing as some things you've told us in the past.
It's not, though, because, again...
Really interesting, though.
Yeah, if anything, because they were hacked, we got the 0 days patch. So if anything, we're slightly more secure. So, you know, short-term good news, long-term no news. Security Lite, then, it was Patch Tuesday. So amidst all these other patches of 0 days, there was also just a regular Patch Tuesday. So there was stuff from Adobe, Oracle, and Microsoft. So Windows, Flash, and Java got updates. And also Office for the Mac was one of the versions of Office that got updated. So Mac users have a security update as well.
Well, that's fun.
Exactly. In terms of security news, Microsoft are courting some controversy. The latest build, or the latest terms and conditions for Windows 10 are out, and for home users, updates are not optional. You don't get to choose whether or not they get installed. They will be installed automatically, and your only choice is whether you reboot now or later. That has the advantage of meaning that there will be much fewer exploitable PCs out there, and the disadvantage that if Microsoft make a mess of an update, they're just going to break lots of computers all over the place.
Yeah, what do you think about this?
I think it's too far. I applaud the idea of having there be less exploitable computers, but I think this is probably too far. At the very least, you should be able to say, hold this one back for a day so that you can let other people go first, and then Microsoft can pull the update when it breaks people's PCs. Yeah. I think this is too far.
I'm thinking about I've never seen it be catastrophic on OS X, but we definitely saw it be catastrophic on, what was it? It was iOS 8.0.1 or something that basically exploded who got it early.
Yeah, it didn't it stop your phone from making phone calls, which seems pretty fundamental to a phone.
I'm just surprised anybody noticed that, but...
I probably would. To be honest.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, how did they even figure that one out? That's so obscure. But I was listening to Alex Lindsay on MacBreak Weekly, and he was talking about the best OS of his favorite OS 10 is 10.8.6, and that every time he's got this set of hardware, every time he tries to go up to the next version, it dies, it doesn't work, and he's unwilling to replace that hardware yet, and so he keeps these machines doing this task on 10.8.6, and that should be his choice, right?
No, because you can't expect security companies to keep stuff forever. There is a halfway house somewhere between...
Wait, what security companies are you talking about?
Microsoft. You can't expect Microsoft to keep giving you security updates for stuff that's two major versions of the OS behind.
I didn't say he should be given security updates.
Oh, okay.
I said he should have the choice to run an insecure system because it solves a business problem for him. And he's taking a risk by if he allows that machine on the internet.
Well, you see, what's interesting is that home users have no choice. Business people who pay for the pro version of Windows 10 will be allowed to delay for a few days. And people who have the enterprise version of Windows 10 can delay for 8 months.
Only 8 months?
Hmm. Why? Okay, well, so 8 months is an awful lot more than zero, but you're right.
No, only 8 months. I mean, the company I used to work for didn't go to Windows 7 till, I want to say, like 3 years after it came out, at least two.
Yeah, well, this is part of the new software as a service model that Microsoft are going with. And also they're saying that Windows 10 is the Windows. So what's going to happen is there's not going to be these big jumps from Windows to Windows. It's going to be rolling updates to Windows 10 for the foreseeable future. There is no Windows 11. So it's a whole new model, and it's really going to be interesting to watch it bet in because people are going to have to change.
I'd like to make a bet on July 18th, 2015, that within 1 month this will be reversed. This decision by Microsoft,
You're correct. I hope you're correct because at the very least, home users need to be able to give in some wiggle room, and not necessarily the same as enterprise, but some wiggle room for goodness sake.
Yeah, so. I'm the sit there hitting refresh to be the first one to screw up my computer when a new OS comes out. But I don't expect anyone else to feel that way. I mean, it just, that's rough.
My prediction is that they don't back down until they do something silly and they push out an update that breaks lots of computers and then they really have their tail between their legs.
Well, I know the enterprise one thing's just simply not going to fly. I mean, there's just as dumb as I think the company I worked for was in taking so long to push an upgrade. But let's just take the fact that how many companies completely skipped Vista.
Yeah, but that's why Microsoft are not going for these monolithic. Because there's going to be no massive jumps. It's going to be slow, continual updates.
So they're never going to have a whole new redesign of their operating system. They're never, ever again going to do
officially. Right now, there are no plans for anything after Windows 10. Windows 10 is it. It is going to be rolling updates, sort of like OS 10 on the Mac, we are now on these slow rolling updates instead of, in fact, this is even more piecemeal than Apple have gone.
Yeah. All right. Well, you heard it here. That's our predictions.
We shall
see. It's all going to go to hell in a handbasket in any case.
I can promise you one thing. It'll be interesting.
Exactly.
Also on the good news column, Dark Code is sort of a well-known cybercrime forum for quite some time where you can go in and buy credit cards or buy exploitation code or all sorts of nasty stuff. It's one of the places Brian Krebs does an awful lot of his research, but 70 people were arrested in a coordinated international takedown. So Dark Code is no more. There's a link in the show notes to the story about the takedown and another link to Brian Krebs describing what Dark Code was.
Yeah, what was it?
A forum where hackers went to sell their wares.
Oh, okay. And not the good kind.
No. So basically, I would like to build a botnet. I will go buy a botnet. I will go to Dark Code and I will buy a botnet. I'll give someone so many Bitcoin and they will give me the exploitation code to build a botnet.
So
I would like some credit cards.
Yeah. Okay. This will just move someplace else then, right?
Possibly, but it will take them time to get as well established. So it's not a terminal blow to cybercrime, but it is nonetheless a setback.
Okay.
So, it'll knock them for six for a wee while, and then they'll get up and they'll go elsewhere. But it's still good. The Guardian are reporting that Google accidentally leaked some information about the right to be forgotten requests, and what they're finding is that 95% are from ordinary people. So the fear with right to be forgotten was that it would be used by criminals, politicians, or public figures to hide past misdeeds. But the reality seems to be that it's used like it was supposed to be, the majority of cases, for ordinary people to protect their privacy. Hmm. So it's a data point. Again, last time we talked about the BBC providing us with another data point. So this is just a data point for when we have a debate on this law, which is going to need... Well, it's not even a law. It's a court ruling, so it needs to become a law. So there's going to be a debate, and this is just another data point in our discussion on this controversial ruling. Security researchers... Right, okay, so the next two are fire extinguisher to hair stories. So they sound scary. There is a problem with RC4. HTTPS and Wi-Fi are in danger. And the headlines were all like, oh, Wi-Fi could be hacked, HTTPS could be hacked.
Wait, what's RC4?
RC4 is a cryptographic cipher, which we have known for quite some time has theoretical weaknesses. And the attacks have been totally and utterly impractical. And now they're... on the verge of practicality.
Okay.
So what this matters to is the industry. The industry needs to plan for the fact that 3 or 4 years from now, RC4 is going to be practically attackable, as in it's going to be really vulnerable. Now it's just theoretically vulnerable. And so we as users have nothing to worry about yet, but the industry need to take note. So this is an interesting research paper. It's good research. It's a great service to the community, but it's no need to panic.
Okay, good.
Similar but somewhat different. There's also another bug in OpenSSL. They happen a lot these days.
They shouldn't have called it OpenSSL. They should have made it closed SSL so it wasn't so vulnerable.
No, OpenSSL is actually being fixed because it's open.
So. Okay, all right.
There is a bug in OpenSSL. The good news is the bug is in a very, very recent version. So in other words...
good.
No, it's cutting-edge stuff that hasn't made it into products yet.
No, that's what I said. I said, oh, good.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I got it, because I hate it when you tell us about stuff that, oh, by the way, this has been in OpenSSL since 1972.
Yeah, those are the bad ones. This is not one of those. So basically, it's a recently added bug. It goes back to March. It hasn't made it into many real-world products. And what's particularly, quote-unquote, good about it is that in the real world, OpenSSL is mostly on servers, and this bug only exists on clients. And our clients that interact with SSL are our web browsers. None of the main web browsers use OpenSSL for their SSL client software. So they are not affected. Even if this version had made it into, you know, had been around for longer, they wouldn't have it anyway. So
Who does have it then? If you said it's only on web browsers, but it's not in web browsers.
No, it's on servers. It's on web servers, not web browsers.
But you said
this is a client-side error. So OpenSSL release a full suite of everything.
Okay.
OpenSSL is like... the garden shed. The OpenSSL just has everything you could possibly have for SSL. Every possible feature anyone ever dreamed of, OpenSSL has all of it, which is why it's so many million lines of code and so brittle, is because it does everything under the kitchen sink, the whole lot's in there. But in reality, the uses we put this massive library to has ended up being that servers tend to use it because it's a very common way Linux does things. But the browser manufacturers don't like giant blobs of code because it's not efficient. Mm-hmm. So they all have their own SSL stack.
Okay.
So in reality, this is actually a problem that affects almost no one.
Oh, so you're saying that if a client had used this piece from OpenSSL, mm-hmm. it would have been vulnerable, but nobody does, or hardly anybody right. does. None of the browsers do, and it can't right. affect the server side. So it was something, yes. It's that tool in the back of the garden shed. Nobody even knows what it's for anymore.
Yeah, it's like that little thing on the Swiss Army knife that no one knows what it is. Yeah, to some extent, it's not quite as extreme as that, but yes, it's basically, okay. it is a problem in theory much more than a problem in practice.
Okay.
So again, no need to panic. Obviously, it's not good, but it's not catastrophic. And a related story. So I've described OpenSSL as this behemoth that does every theoretical possible thing with SSL. Well, a response to Heartbleed and these other vulnerabilities is for people to do alternative SSL implementations that do less.
Hmm.
I'm only interested in server stuff, so I'm going to write a version of SSL that only does what I want. And therefore, my code will be smaller, easier to debug, less likely to be full of bugs all over the place. And there's a couple of them, Libre SSL and a few of them, but there is a new entrant to the market, Amazon, have released their own one called S2N. It's a drop-in replacement for OpenSSL on the server side, and in actual fact, they're using it on their cloud platform.
Interesting. So it's lighter and thinner and makes you look prettier?
Right. So because it's less code, there's less room for bugs to hide in. And it's like dramatically less code.
I like the naked security. Like it's nakedsecurity.sophos.com. Blah, 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 blah. Amazon releases low cholesterol Heartbleed medicine.
Yeah, exactly. That is. Yeah, I like naked security a lot.
That's great.
And yeah, exactly. So that is, you know, so again, it's a positive development. Our SSL is getting stronger and it's all a result of Heartbleed. We're doing a big rethinking. So that's good. Notable breaches, again, quickly through this. CVS Photo just released a thing saying they'd probably been breached. There's a link in the show notes. And that OPM breach is a story that keeps on giving. The good news is the director has finally resigned after telling Congress it was the attacker's fault and all sorts of stupid statements that made people's heads explode. So that's at least something. It's a good read, which is why I have it in the show notes, but there's an article on Ars Technica written by one of the 21 million people affected by this. The title, I believe, is OPM got hacked and all I got was this stupid email, but it's actually a really good article explaining why this matters.
Mm-hmm.
It's not happy reading, because it's not a happy story, but it is good reading. And then also related is Ars Technica have also set up one of these stream pages for the OPM breach, because again, it's a story made up of lots of little stories. And so if you care about OPM, if you're affected by OPM, I would say keep an eye on the Ars Technica feed for OPM, because that way you're getting all the new stories as they happen.
So I figured out a way to feel okay about the OPM breach and all these other breaches. So once you get screwed up, like this federal employee got an email from the federal government saying you've been breached, so we're going to give you 3 years of fraud protection.
18 months, not even 3 years.
Okay, 18 months. Pick any number. Doesn't matter. Because inside of that 18 months, someone else is going to lose your data, and you're going to get another 18 months. See? So it's fine.
So what you're saying is we're all getting de facto perpetual protection.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, that's a silver lining.
I'm looking for it, Bart. I'm digging deep.
Well, we'll give you that one. I mean, we'll pretend there's no problems with it.
Okay.
Finally, just suggested reading. Good article explaining Firefox's upcoming tracking protection feature that I promise will get controversial when it's released to the public. There's a controversial bill making its way through the U.S. legislative process about basically forcing Facebook and Twitter to sort of be government watchdogs. Perhaps worth a read. Very good article on questioning why there's gender discrimination in Google ad profiles, which there is, which I hadn't realized that was an issue, but
it is. What's a Google ad profile? Is that user side or the person creating
the way Google targets ads seems to have a gender bias. And the article is basically questioning how that came to be. I doubt it's intentional. In fact, I'm pretty sure it isn't, but it's interesting.
Why wouldn't it be? I mean, it wouldn't make sense to, you know, market bras to you, right?
Right, but it's a little more subtle. As I say, it's not really good for
maybe quick, they're not showing me tools because of that, and then I'd be pissed off. I'll go read the article.
As a side effect of the algorithm, there seems to be some unwanted behavior. So it's an interesting look at it.
Okay.
And also a good article from Naked Security called simply, "It's Time We Stopped Calling Millennials Dumb About Privacy." because because they are not dumb. They just have a different view, but it's not that the millennials do care about privacy. They just have different, they just set the bar in different places. It's not that they don't care. Two thirds of millennials actually feel very sensitive about these things. It's a good article sort of cutting through the myth that millennials just share everything and don't care.
Okay, okay. Ah, you kids today, you're all idiots.
Well, what I found
back in my time
surprised me. I am a millennial by 10 days.
Oh, look at you. Yeah, and I'm lumped in with the people born during World War II, so, or before World War II, so that's good.
Oh. Okay, that's everything I have. Hopefully we weren't too long.
No, it's fine. It's perfect. People love this segment, and I get a lot out of it, so I enjoyed it.
Okay, good. And hopefully we'll have less security stuff before we do our cool topic with Steve next week.
All right, sounds good. Talk to you soon, Bart.
Okay, talk to you soon. Oh, I should say happy computing, shouldn't I?
Yes, say it.
Until next week, happy computing.
Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond, and I'm excited to invite to the show for the very first time Serenity Caldwell of iMore. How are you doing today, Serenity?
I'm doing well, Allison. Thank you for having me.
This must have been the most interesting scheduling I've ever had to do for the show.
It was a little bit crazy.
Yeah. Well, talk about crazy. iMore.com. I swear, you guys didn't exist like 15 minutes ago, and now you guys are everywhere. I mean, anytime I want to know anything, tips, news, anything, it's all at iMore.
That's very sweet of you to say.
Where did you guys come from? I mean,
well, so
you were
Renee,
there all along, right?
Yeah, Renee Ritchie has actually been doing fabulous work. iMore, I think, has only been called iMore for the last 2 years, and before that it was the iPhone blog. But Renee has been doing fabulous work for about 4 or 5 years over there. Pretty much Dieter Bonn, who now works for The Verge, kind of plucked him out of the forums and was like, make this site magical. And Renee's kind of been chugging hard. And then I came on board last October. We had Peter Cohen and Ali Kazmuha for a while. Now it's Renee and I, and we're going to hire a couple more people now that the site's really kind of taken off. I feel like a lot of hard work that's been put into fruition finally.
Yeah, it's a site that's not only really compelling with the content, but it's also beautiful to navigate. And I'm not a hardcore print font kind of person, but I know Renee is, and I've just been just blown away. I mean, the only place I went to learn about photos was to you guys. There was just no point looking anywhere else. And now you've taken on part of our scheduling excitement was, that little Apple Music thing dropped?
That thing. Who knows about that, really?
There was no subtleties or anything to that, right?
No. That was cut and dry. Yeah, the Apple Music was a little funny in that I was expecting, I'll write an FAQ. It'll be fine. That will be that. And then the first day in, I'm like, Music and Match are kind of similar. Maybe I should compare and contrast. Yeah, and then that article got updated 7 times in the next 24 hours because I was constantly learning things and constantly like trying to deconstruct. I was like, wait a second, Match users are getting DRM track? Wait, what's going? So,
which they're not.
They're not.
Okay.
Yes, they are not the TLDR version of Apple Music versus iTunes Match is that. Both Apple Music and iTunes Match use what's called the iCloud Music Library to let you share music with all of your devices, technically up to 10 devices that you own. The difference comes from the fact that Apple Music, when it's matching tracks, it looks through your library and it says, you own this? We also have a copy of this in much higher quality sound resolution. So we're going to use this copy on our devices. The difference is that Apple Music matches to the Apple Music catalog, which happens to have FairPlay DRM on it because it's streaming music, because you can't download a song from the Apple Music catalog and expect to keep it forever because it's a subscription service.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And iTunes Match is matching from the iTunes Store catalog, which is DRM free because the iTunes Store has been DRM free for the last couple of years. Yeah, exactly. for quite a while now. Steve Jobs was still walking the earth when the iTunes Store went DRM free. So people were getting up in arms like, wait, Apple's DRMing my library. And it's like, no. Apple, if you are using just Apple Music, Apple is putting DRM on songs you're downloading from that catalog, which may happen to be matched with songs that you own on your Mac, but they're not transcoding those songs.
Would you have two copies then if you had the original and one from iTunes Music?
Correct. So if you're your original Mac, right? Let's say you have a Beatles CD, right? Mm-hmm. Actually, Beatles is a bad example.
Grateful Dead works for Mac.
Yeah, you get a Grateful Dead CD, right? And you've ripped it to your computer, and you have those songs on your computer stored locally. They're MP3s or AACs, 256 kilobits. They're give or take like that. Those are your tracks, and they're on your computer. And you turn on Apple Music and you say, yes, I would love iCloud Music Library. When you load those tracks on, say, an iPhone or another Mac, those tracks, if you decide to download them for offline listening, will download from the Apple Music catalog because Apple Music says, hey, we have that Grateful Dead CD. Rather than spending your upload bandwidth uploading
to push it up
to
and pull
iCloud.
It back down.
Yeah, exactly. We're just going to use our copies and save you the hassle and save us the hassle of having to store the extra stuff. And so those copies on auxiliary devices are copy protected because they're being pulled from the Apple Music catalog.
At the risk of excessively gushing over what you guys are doing at iMore, I think what stands out to me is that you heard what was going on and people getting all inflammatory. Most people just report, the sky is falling, and you're thinking, yeah. I just picture you thinking, well, does that make sense? Let me run some design of experiments, right? Let me do this, and this, and find out what's really happening. Because usually when it sounds ridiculously inflammatory, it's usually not true. Good or bad inflammatory, right? Too good to be true, too bad to be true.
Exactly. I was getting furious reading Twitter where people were like, Apple's DRMing your entire library and the sky is falling and Apple Music is the worst thing ever. And these are coming from reputable publications. You know, I was reading stuff from The Verge and from Mac Observer and a couple other places where I was just scratching my head. I'm like, this can't be right. And I'm looking and I'm trying to compare it to what I've written and I'm trying to figure out what's going on because I said this on Don Melton's show earlier this week. I have the unlucky position of being one of the few people that I know who has never had an iTunes match problem. I have a library of about 20,000 tracks, but I've never had a problem with artwork. I've never had a problem with mismatched songs. And I didn't have the problem where sometimes iTunes match users were mistakenly getting Apple Music tracks, which was a bug, which is fixed for most people. That's a bug. And That's the other thing, right?
Go crazy when it's just come out.
Exactly. It's understandable that people were a little bit nervous because they're like, wait, what's going on? What? And Apple was not very forthcoming about documentation or about, hey, this is a bug. We know this is a bug. It's okay. So everybody wrote these big inflammatory pieces. And I guess at iMore, one of our sort of core tenets is FUD busting, which is to say We're in it to help the user, and we're in it to make sure that the user does not panic over the use of their device. So when I see crazy headlines like that, my primary goal is, okay, let's find the truth in it, and let's explain how, you know, if users are having problems, how they can fix said problems, or at least be less panicked.
Or know what the pitfalls are before you fall into them. That's another way to go, right?
Yes. Know that maybe it's smart to back up your library before you try a cloud service, especially if you have custom metadata and album artwork. You know, maybe.
Yeah.
Just a thought.
You know, my audience is screaming into their iPhones and other devices right now because I haven't confessed to you that I don't listen to music at all.
Oh, my.
There's a syndrome that has been identified, and I believe I have it. It's called music-specific anhedonia. And anhedonia means you're apathetic. Basically, you have no emotional reaction to anything. And 2 years ago, they discovered that there is music-specific anhedonia, where it's not that I don't like music, I just don't have any reaction to it. It's like, yeah, it's okay. It's fine. So they're laughing that I'm participating in this discussion. But what I like about the stuff that you've done is I've learned from you the stuff about Music Match, and I was actually able to help somebody yesterday where they're going, well, wait a minute, I heard. And I, well, no, that's not exactly what happened. So the FUD busting has extended beyond there, so that's kind of nice.
Oh, good. Yeah, that's always something that makes me happy, too, when people are actually able to extend this knowledge to other people. Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, no, Mom, you don't have to panic. Your iPhone is – you're not holding your iPhone the wrong way.
Right. So I think music has been just the latest in what you had to FUD bust is a lot of the inflammatory stuff about photos.
Yes.
I mean, people lost their ever-loving minds about photos, especially that they were convinced they had to.
Yes.
They had to go. They had no choice.
And it definitely wasn't voluntary or the fact that you can use any other organization platform that you'd like. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. I've actually been really enjoying it. So I don't know.
Yeah. Photos works quite well for me. I had a couple of hiccups when I first started, and I definitely have some nitpicks about like what I would like to change
sure.
in the app going forward. But overall, I think it's a really good 1.0 product from Apple. It's a much stronger 1.0 product than they've put out of their other cloud services. And they've had some time to iterate on it with iCloud photo sharing and with PhotoStream for the last couple of years. So yes, it's not what Aperture is. In fact, Apple was very clear that it's not an Aperture replacement. It's not a Lightroom replacement, and that's okay. It is the app for the majority of people who are using photos and would like photos on all of their devices.
Yeah,
and I think
yeah.
once people realize that, it becomes a little less scary.
It actually, I did a post on how it got me to buy a 12-inch MacBook because I've got a MacBook Pro with a 1 terabyte drive because I always wanted all of my photos with me all the time. I'm really into my photos, and I've got a 380 gig photo library, so that was not going to happen on any other device. But
no.
I was able to buy the MacBook because I can have the optimized images now. So now we just went to India for a month, and I carried a 5-pound laptop the whole way through, I think it was like 7 or 8 different hotel changes. And everything,
oh
and it was
gosh.
A nightmare. But
yeah.
now I can just carry this little device, and I've got my photos when I want them, and I just love it. I love being out to dinner last night. Somebody mentioned something from like 12 years ago, and I went on my phone. Went, oh, you mean this photo? You know, I've got it with me all the time. I just love it.
Yeah, it's right there in your pocket.
But I didn't even ask you on to talk about music or photos. What I wanted to talk to you about was home automation. And I want to start with kind of like, can you give us a state of the union on home automation? Where are we? Is there a standard yet? is it time to go beyond the baby steps? And then maybe we can start folding in where HomeKit comes into things.
Absolutely. So from where I can tell, there's been a lot of dabbling in home automation over the last 20, 30 years. You know, we've been talking about the home of the future and the home that will do itself, you know, do everything for you since the 60s, basically. So then since even before that, dishwashers were one of the very first kind of what you think of as home automation projects. It's a machine that can do your dishes for you.
That's
you don't have
point.
To stand. Yeah. I mean, home automation is something that I think has been a long running thread. When we think about modern home automation, we think about cell phone activated or remote activated automation that allows us to open blinds, turn on lights, schedule timers. Again, the earliest form of this I think of is like the Christmas tree light timer, right? Where you preset a certain time, and then the lights come on at a certain time and they go off at a certain time. But we've really made some advancements with the advent of the smartphone. We have the ability to control our lights remotely over Wi-Fi. So primarily, there have been a lot of different home automation vendors who have all created their specific kits. And their specific subkits, and you see those ranging from, it's actually quite affordable these days, but you know, when they started out, it was something like 50 to 100 grand to outfit your home with blinds that went up and down and lights that turned on and off at your commands. And now we've seen more into it's like the $3,000 to $10,000 range, which is still far beyond the price range of the average American who's like,
just to be lazy, I can flick that switch by myself.
Yeah, exactly. It's like,
oh, I also like the fact that half of the stuff half of the stuff at CES was automating your home so you didn't have to get off the couch, and the other half was exercise stuff to get you off the couch.
Yep. It's like, oh, well, you don't have to worry about getting up to flick a switch, but you can try our fancy exercise automated treadmill.
And you better stand up now. It's 10 till.
Yep. I'm at a standing desk right now, so I guess something must have worked. But yeah, so where kind of Apple fits in is that we have all of these competing platforms, and we have all of these sort of little piecemeal things. So we had the era of complete sets, and then a couple of years ago, folks like Philips Hue came in and Belkin Wemo, where they're like, well, you know, the average American may not want to automate everything in their home. Maybe they just want to, you know, plug and play kind of thing. So we'll give them individual bulbs that can change colors.
$100 deal, right?
Exactly. It's like when people have to spend under $1,000 to outfit maybe a room, then it becomes a lot more doable. And, oh, hey, those lights can color coordinate with what you're watching on TV. That's kind of cool, right?
So a little bit party trick, but yeah, I bought them.
Exactly, exactly. So you've got sort of this piecemeal stuff. And Apple is kind of looking at this being like, so all of our users have 10 different apps for the various piecemeal utilities that they're using. And in general, home automation, in order to achieve these connections between these devices and your iPhone or your iPad, they're all incredibly insecure Bluetooth and Wi-Fi connections. So
I don't think we ever talked about that before. No. Apple started talking about it, right?
Because by and large, when you think about it, you need proximity really to hack into somebody's home automation system. And it's not right. Necessarily something, again, because it's not wide enough adopted.
Adoption.
There's not enough adoption worldwide for people to be like, you remember like war drivers who would go around looking for open Wi-Fi spots. There are not war drive hackers for home automation systems where they're looking around, oh, someone has an unprotected nest. I'm going to play with things.
Right. Because you don't know if it's going to be a nest or you just turn the light bulb on, but it's probably not their front door lock yet.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not quite to the point where people would be worrying about it, but it's still slightly disconcerting. And especially when Apple kind of
pointed at it.
Yeah, took a magnifying glass and said, hey, look at how terrible these things that are supposedly, you know, to secure your home. Look at how terrible the security is around this. I don't think you want to install a smart door lock that could talk to somebody else's phone with a six-character hack.
Quicksets had door locks for quite a while, so mm-hmm. they weren't hardware encrypted.
Maybe. I assume that there's some kind of encryption, but it's just in terms – so the local encryption, the encryption between like
the hub itself.
Yeah, exactly. And like someone couldn't necessarily hack it by standing directly to it. The problem comes when accessing the Wi-Fi points, and if it's not an encrypted connection to there, and especially if it's a relay, if it's trying to build a cloud network to relay to the phone – that data being passed unencrypted is dangerous. Because if someone's like, your lock password is flying through the air to your phone in unencrypted data, the people who know how to look for that, it's potentially a bad idea.
So I've got some friends. My friend Chris Ashley and Rod Simmons both put in Insteon all through their houses.
Mm-hmm.
And when HomeKit got announced, they said that Insteon would have to they would have to do hardware encryption in order to be part of HomeKit, right?
Mm.
But that doesn't mean they have to replace all the switches they just finished wiring all over their house.
No. So this is the one really nice thing about HomeKit. So we're talking about, again, the signals between the devices themselves and the central access point, namely the Wi-Fi router, because the Wi-Fi router is how a potential intruder would get into these devices. So what Apple's idea with HomeKit is that they offer two paths. They're like, we want hardware encrypted devices that offer Bluetooth and Wi-Fi access, or Bluetooth or Wi-Fi access.
Okay.
And we'll allow you to do this in one of two ways. You can either build this encryption chip into your hardware. So there are certain devices like Elgato's Eve line all has that chip built into their individual things. And you could do that. You could replace every single little individual thing with a hardware chip. But the hardware chip's expensive, and that doesn't really make sense for things like lights, right? You don't need every individual light talking to the Wi-Fi router securely. Ideally, you want all of the lights talking to a central resource and that central resource talking to the Wi-Fi router. So
the light bulbs wouldn't have the encryption, but they all talk to this hub, and then that hub talks to the router. And
exactly.
That hub has that one hub has the chip in it.
Correct. Okay. So the light bulbs can only talk in a localized manner. So they only talk to the hub, which is in your house, over a secure connection, and then that hub encrypts all of that data and sends it to your router over an Ethernet line. From there, you can control
only
it.
Only over locally. Ethernet or over?
I believe most of the hubs have to be Ethernet wired. At least the ones that I've seen. Yeah. I know. I need more router ports.
Yeah.
More WAN parts. But yeah, so I have, I actually have a Lutron light hub in my basement right now, and it's hooked up to my router, and I have a couple of different Lutron dimmers. So when I say to Siri, turn off the lights, Siri talks to the Lutron hub, and then the Lutron hub gives the, or sorry, Siri talks via Wi-Fi to the Lutron hub, and then the Lutron hub gives those commands, now encrypted, to the various lights.
So let me hold that, because I don't understand at all how that's happening. But let me back up and ask a very dumb question here.
Sure.
What is HomeKit? HomeKit isn't a physical thing, right? Is it a series of protocols? Is it a set of rules? What is it?
HomeKit is a software development kit, with a combination of a hardware side, which is less so proprietary hardware from Apple and more, this is a standard that we are adopting. And if you want your devices to work with HomeKit, you have to make sure that you have this chip in it. It's not a chip that Apple makes. It's just a certain encryption standard for Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. So if you want a HomeKit device, your Wi-Fi or your Bluetooth connection needs to be encrypted in this way, and you need to have basically a secure enclave type chip in your device.
So HomeKit it's not a standard, really. It's a set of rules.
Correct.
This, and you get to say HomeKit enabled.
Yes, it's a set of hardware and a set of hardware rules. And then also a software development kit, some software that hooks into your device, namely your iPhone or your iPad, and can communicate between your iPhone and iPad to your lights, your blinds, whatever have you, without needing another app, without being like, oh yeah, I need to download 20 different apps.
Okay. So is HomeKit also an app on your iPhone?
It is not. HomeKit exists. HomeKit exists in the background. I think the best way to think about it is kind of like CarPlay, which is another one of Apple's kind of overarching software things, where it's an under the scenes framework that talks.
Okay, like a layer underneath, kind of.
Exactly.
So when you back to what you said about your lights, you're saying you talk to your phone, you talk to Siri, and Siri knows that hub is following some hardware guidelines and therefore knows it's allowed to talk to that app?
Yeah. So when you first buy a HomeKit device and you set it up, you have to set up either the hub or the device itself to the internet. And you download the app initially to connect that. They usually have specific apps. So like Lutron has an app for Cassetta Wireless, which is the series of lights that I have. So when you download this app and you install your router on top of your little hub or on top of the individual device, there's a little device setup code that says HomeKit device setup code, and then it gives you a string of 6 to 8 numbers. So when you set up that hub in HomeKit, when you set it up in the app, it says, okay, please enter in the code. And you enter it. It's almost like pairing with a device via Bluetooth. So you enter in that code, and then that device gets added to your home. Your home is linked to your iCloud account. So when you add your first HomeKit device, you create, say, Serenity Caldwell's home. And Serenity Caldwell's home is linked to my iCloud account. So that I can control Serenity Caldwell's home on any device that I have that also has that iCloud account installed or linked to. Okay. And I can add if there are other people who live in my home or who need access to my home, I can add their iCloud account and then they can have access to my home.
So there's a lot more setup initially of something like that. But then once you get that set up and you go, now you get an Insteon hub, you wouldn't need to do as much. You just need to tell the Insteon hub, okay, here's the account to hook into.
Exactly. When you say I go out and I buy an Insteon hub and I have Insteon lights, I get home, I plug in my Insteon hub, I put in the Ethernet cable, I launch the Insteon app, and the Insteon app says, oh, you're setting up a new hub? What's the HomeKit code? I enter in that HomeKit code and it says, great. Then Insteon hub is now added to Serenity Caldwell's home. And how from there...
How did it know to ask you for a HomeKit hub or a HomeKit code, though? What if I'm a Windows user and I don't have HomeKit? Would it still be asking me for that? Or did it sense it?
It depends on what what device you're setting up. So if you're setting up a HomeKit, if you're setting up an Insteon hub for HomeKit, and there are two different kinds, there's the non-HomeKit hub and the HomeKit hub. Oh. If you're setting up the HomeKit hub, the app knows, oh, this is a HomeKit device, and prompts you for that code. If you're setting up a device that wouldn't have the HomeKit code, then you wouldn't see it.
I'm thinking of mixed households. You know, there are people mm-hmm. like that. I'm not one of them, but my friends are, where they've got Android and iOS and Windows phones and, you know, all kinds of things. They could still buy a HomeKit-enabled Insteon hub, but then use it with the other devices, I assume.
Absolutely. So the hub may be compatible with HomeKit, but it also links to the Insteon app, which I believe is available on Android as well as iOS.
Windows
I have
phone.
To check. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it definitely is. Yeah.
So,
yeah. Okay.
So
okay, I'm starting to get
the others,
bit.
Yeah, the others can control it with the app. But with HomeKit, what makes HomeKit special on iOS devices is that you can use Siri to control the on and off, nice. As well as shut it off remotely from Siri if you have an Apple TV. So the main difference, or the main, like the two main things about HomeKit that make HomeKit special is A, secure encryption for the devices that you're talking to, so you don't have to worry about that network getting hacked into, and B, easy access with Siri as opposed to opening the app, finding the folder that the app is in, you know, finding the light, turning the light, you know, on, off, dimming it, etc.
Right, right. Well, it sounds like even if you were a Windows user, Windows phone user who had it set up, it would be a good idea to get the HomeKit enabled version just because it does have the hardware end-to-end encryption.
Absolutely.
And it would still count even though your phone was never involved in that?
Correct.
Okay. That's good to know. I know you can control the Insteon devices with Cortana on Windows phone. So
that was
a cool advantage of that. I like it. So you talked about a thermostat that really sounded like it was going to solve the problem for me, and I can't remember the name of it. Might have had 3 or E in the name.
The Echo Bee. Yeah, the Echo Bee.
Yeah, Echo Bee.
Yeah.
Yeah, so where you put
Echo
sensors
really
all over the house?
Yeah, so the Echo Bee, I actually have a Nest in my house, and I'm a little bummed because the Nest will not work with HomeKit because it doesn't have that encryption. Mm-hmm. Although, fun fact, any device that doesn't have the encryption, if say Google were to look at the Nest and say, actually, I would love for the Nest to be HomeKit enabled, I'm going to have it talk to a Nest hub, or I'm going to have it talk to a HomeKit hub that already exists. Uh-huh. Google could update the software on that, on say the Nest, to make that work.
Oh, they because the hub has to have the encryption, not the device. Oh.
Exactly. So Google would have to work to make it talk to one of the hubs. But if it did that, then the hub could relay the thermostat information to Siri and to HomeKit with no
problem.
It
might be a pipe dream, but it's a possibility.
Yes,
anyway.
Exactly. Well, Google's very looking into it. But the Echo Bee actually, or the newest version of the Echo Bee 3 has HomeKit support built in. So it has this end-to-end encryption chip embedded into it. And what's really cool about the Echo Bee in contrast with the Nest is that the Echo Bee not only uses the sensor that's placed in the wall to tell you what temperature is. So, you know, say you put it in your hallway, right? Your hallway mm-hmm. is always going to be a little bit warmer because there's a window nearby.
Upstairs.
Yeah, exactly. Hot air rises to the top, so it's not mm-hmm. cooling efficiently. Well, the Echo Bee comes with extra little sensors that you just stick in corners of other rooms, and then you let it know sensor one is in the bedroom, sensor two is in the downstairs garage, sensor three is in the office. And from there, it says, okay, well, I can figure out how the whole house is being cooled, and I can say, oh, the office needs more cooling, so I will continue to have the cooling run as opposed to shutting it off because the hallway says, oh, this has reached, you know, 75 degrees. I'm going to turn it off.
So lest we lead people to think that we believe that a thermostat can change the temperature in different rooms differently.
Oh, yeah.
It's not doing that. It's just saying, as I recall, you said on one of the shows that it's not only sensing the temperature in the room, it's sensing that you are in the room.
Correct. Correct. So
it might get a little weird if you got somebody upstairs and somebody downstairs, but at least in the evenings when we're downstairs and it's hot upstairs but freezing downstairs, it might send some heat our way.
Absolutely. Yeah. It'll know what rooms you're in and realize, oh, well, this room isn't heated well enough. So let's bump up the heating and not shut it off just because the hallway sensor says, oh no, it's hot in here.
Yeah. Yeah. I really think that sounds like fun. So you got one of the new ones. I think you had bought one right before the new ones came out.
Yeah, I have an old Nest. Georgia Dow is actually getting one of the new ones and she's going to be trying it out relatively soon.
Of the Echo B3s, you mean?
Of the Echo B3s. Yeah. Okay. She's pretty excited. She had an Echo B before that she really liked. And I think we wrote a whole tutorial on getting one and setting it up and all of that jazz. So I know she's going to update that when she gets her new one.
Yeah, yeah. She's really got her geek on this subject for
sure. Oh, yeah, for sure.
I love it. She's into it. So what did we hope that Apple was going to announce at WWDC that they didn't?
Oh, gosh. In terms of HomeKit. Well,
sorry. Let me narrow that. Yeah, in terms of HomeKit.
Well, they actually did announce quite a few things that were exciting. They announced more product categories. Obviously, HomeKit was first announced at WWDC in 2014. So in 2015, they mentioned, oh, well, with iOS 9, we're opening up HomeKit so that you can have HomeKit encrypted accessories for even more types, including blinds, including door locks. Those weren't
so
initially offered.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
I think the initial round was lights and plugs. And so they've expanded that for iOS 9. They're also working so that it's not necessary to have an Apple TV if you want to relay your Siri commands outside of the house. Currently, with HomeKit, if you're just using your iPhone and you don't have an Apple TV, you can give Siri commands like turn off the lights while you're in the house. But the second you leave the protected Wi-Fi network, Siri loses the connection because it's not talking to your Wi-Fi network anymore. The Apple TV is really nice because when you have the Apple TV plugged in, the Wi-Fi router talks to the Apple TV and says, hey, there's a HomeKit home here. So the Apple TV grabs that signal and embeds that in the, you know, in say Serenity at iCloud.com. So when I say turn off the lights, even if I'm on LTE or if I'm out of the house,
wow,
it talks to the Apple TV and says, hey, here's a command. Do we have a HomeKit device here and can we make sense of it? And the Apple TV says, yes, Serenity's home is here and she has three lights. I'm going to go do that right now.
So the Apple did not announce an Apple TV as a hub, and yet, in a way, the Apple TV is acting as a hub today.
Yeah, so the Apple TV, right now is acting as a relay more than a hub, in that it is relaying commands.
Just handoff, not doing anything, like the difference between a switch and a router.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. It's just passing data through. It's not an active, it does not have the encryption chip in it, so it cannot be an active hub.
Okay, right.
There are some people who are hoping and praying that Apple's next Apple TV will be a HomeKit hub.
One of them lives in my house. please, he says every day.
It would be great. It would be fabulous. But I'm a little skeptical on it because it would require either an enormous amount of work from Apple to work with device manufacturers or an enormous amount of work from device manufacturers to work with Apple.
Apple never has a problem with that.
Oh, no. It's entirely
making everybody
possible.
Else do the work.
It's true. It's
here,
true.
Change your packaging here to look just like ours.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a whole nother Oprah right there.
But yeah, so iOS 9 will remove that restriction. So the Apple TV doesn't have to act as a pass-through. It will actually work in iOS 9 where you can just relay your iCloud account will connect itself wirelessly to your Wi-Fi network even when you're off of it. I'm not sure the technical details of how that works because I haven't dived into those developer sessions yet, but it's supposed to work and be awesome. And then there's the question of the new Apple TV. Will a new Apple TV offer a HomeKit hub? And will it be magical? I know a lot of people were magical. A lot of people
of course
were.
It will be.
Yeah, of course. There were a lot of hopes also for a HomeKit app on the phone.
Oh, okay.
With the idea being, right now, HomeKit kind of lives in the accessory apps. So there's a section that's like, oh, you want to control your HomeKit rooms and your HomeKit zones, which allows you to do really cool things like, say, Siri, turn off the space station and the lights in whatever room you've documented as the space station will turn off.
Have you done that?
I have. Surprise. Surprise, surprise.
Shocked, I'm shocked.
Yeah, exactly. So those commands, people are a little disappointed, myself included, that Apple doesn't have a standalone app. Of course.
So then one app to rule them all that would talk to all the other apps?
Exactly.
What benefit would that give you? Because you can already talk to the space station.
Yeah, you can already talk to the space station. So the advantage to having a centralized HomeKit app would be to be able to see all of your accessories, as well as control renaming of your rooms, your zones, and those accessories okay. from that place, and unpairing accessories if need be.
So instead of having to teach your thermostat and your lights that this is the space station, that it would all know it from that?
Exactly. Right. Okay. So right now, say the Echo Bee, right? The Echo Bee app has that little section, right? It's like five different apps have that same little rooms and zones section.
Okay.
And having a centralized HomeKit app would allow just one place to go to that rather than, okay, I'm going to my Echo Bee app to change the name of my thermostat. And then I'm going to my Lutron app to change the name of my lights. And then I'm going to my Elgato Eve app to see what my weather's looking like.
You know, I've got a perfect analogy to this. It's when we sit down to watch TV and we go, okay, I want to watch Orange is the New Black. Where is that again? Was that on Amazon
Prime?
Was that
Netflix?
On Netflix? Is
yeah.
that on my Roku? Is that my Apple TV? Did I TiVo that? Is that Showtime? No. That one's on HBO. Is that HBO Go? And I could just picture I'm going to have these 12 different devices going, honey, which one's the lights again?
Yeah, exactly.
And we're good at this stuff.
And that's why Siri is a huge value in this case, especially if we're doing sort of piecemeal HomeKit, because I can just say, Siri, turn on the lights in the bedroom, and Siri will understand what I'm talking about.
Oh, so Siri knows that whether it's the Echo Bee or the Lutron or whatever. Oh, that's
exactly
nice.
Because you've taught it in those individual apps. If you right. had a centralized app, though, it would allow you to just do that a little bit quicker.
Okay, well, that's not quite as bad as yeah. I thought, though.
No, so, it's not super complicated.
How do you feel about door locks?
Door locks.
Do you still get that queasy feeling in the pit of your stomach, or are you feeling bold? What's your address again?
Good, yeah. If there was a good HomeKit-enabled door lock, I think that Apple's encryption is fantastic, and I'm not concerned about that.
Okay.
I do think it's kind of I feel like the Skynet. I think about the Skynet possibilities sometimes. Where I'm just thinking, oh boy, well, if the machines take over. Yeah, but the machines take over, locking me outside of my house will kind of be the least of my worries.
You got other troubles. Sure.
Yeah, exactly. And there's, you know what, there's a pickaxe in my backyard and like the shed. I can always
the dogs?
Yeah, exactly. The dogs will eat any machines.
There you go.
I've seen them eat cans before, so. But yes. I could do it.
The a friend of mine was talking about how, you know, the typical non-nerd person saying, well, that's terrifying, you know, the idea of that. And I said, yeah, you do know that people can take a picture of your key from like, you know, 300 feet away and make a mold of your key and unlock your front door, right? You know yeah. that's already possible. And that's
there
all
are
analog.
Other of crazy things.
I remember when I left a friend of mine in charge of my cats, and I gave him a key to the house, and we were going to be gone for 2 weeks, and I had accidentally given him a key to my mother's house instead of my house.
Oh, gosh.
So he called the locksmith, and the guy came over and unlocked the house. Never asked him a single question about, like, do you actually live here?
No. Nope.
Yeah, hey, once you got this open, can you open the next four for me while you're here? So
it's insane.
Yeah, I don't worry as much about that stuff as some people. Well, I think I've gotten a pretty good idea of what HomeKit is now. It's still a little bit squishy to me, but I think I'm going to buy my husband Steve one of those Echo Bees and just put it in his room and see what he does with it.
Yeah, just put really it on fun. The desk. See if he'll take the bait.
Yeah. But before I let you go, I wanted to ask you, you're a big old hardcore roller derby chick, right?
I am.
That is so awesome. I just love
Thank
that.
You.
So, but I've heard you complain on several shows that the Apple Watch doesn't give you credit. And let's face it, it's all about credit, right? I mean, that's what it really is about. Why does other not work for you on roller derby?
So other is not a bad measurement. What essentially, when there's not a specifically designed workout for you, other is just taking sort of a combination. Rate? Yeah, it's taking your heart rate, it's taking your exertion, and it's taking the length of your activity and how long your heart rate is up at its max to try and figure out how many calories you're burning. And that's not terrible. Like that's a good baseline. And I'd say in general, the Apple Watch is probably within 300 calories of what I consider what I'm doing normally. Mm-hmm. The major problem comes in when you add in strength training and resistance training, because chances are my heart rate is going to be near my max if I'm lifting 50 pounds or if I'm lifting 200 pounds. You know, okay. if I'm doing 50 pounds for a certain.
Can you do 200 pounds? I scare me a little bit. Yeah, you know?
at my best, I could do 120, and I felt at a max one rep, and I felt very good about that. But wow. It's been a long time since that. but yeah, in general, it's not quite taking in the kinds of resistance that you're doing with skating. You know, you're working a certain subset of muscle groups that can necessarily burn calories a little bit faster. Sure. You're dealing with extreme heat and extreme cold, depending on how our warehouse is, which also comes into play. Because obviously if the human body is too hot, it's shedding moisture at an alarming rate. If it's too cold, then it needs to warm itself up while it's being exerted.
And that's burning calories.
And that's
ways.
Burning
sure.
calories. Exactly. Okay. So I am not a scientist. And I should have prefaced that with like, I am not a scientist and I have a very rudimentary understanding of how this works. But my general understanding is that it just, because it can't really quite understand resistance and it can't understand, also physical violence, for instance.
Scaring me again.
Well, so roller derby is a full contact sport, and our hits are primarily hip checks and shoulder checks. There's no elbowing, there's no punching, there's no tripping or anything like
no
that.
No headers.
No, exactly. No headbutting, strictly illegal. But when you're hip checking somebody, or when if you're coming into a pack at hot, when you're trying to score points and you're sort of, you know, pushing your way past people with your shoulders, when you're getting impacted, that is going to cause a certain amount of calorie burning as well, because your body's like, oh, protection mode.
Yeah, so, interesting.
Yeah, it's a very different sport than, say, running.
It would be interesting to see what kind of metrics they would come up. And my guess is Apple will hear this, and not hear this show, but hear you in general, and there will be the Serenity Caldwell mode that you can press for roller
yes,
derby.
Yes, special mode. Oh, I have already filed radars, and I know a couple people on the health team, and I'm already very much like, hi, guys, please.
That would be hilarious.
I know this is a niche sport, but please. No, actually, I was kind of disappointed because they show in the commercial, in the very first Apple Watch commercial, they show a girl ice skating and with an Apple Watch on her wrist doing a spin. And I assumed from there, oh, there's going to be a skating sports option. And skating sports is, would be a mile above other. Because it knows that what muscle groups you're working, and it knows like heart rate and how to incorporate all of that.
You're lucky it'll be incorporating things like spinning in place instead.
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of hip checks.
iOS 9, we should see some improvement with this, especially because third-party apps will get access to the full range of the Apple Watch's sensors. So that means that, in theory, somebody could write me a roller derby app. Instead of relying on Apple's default exercise app.
That's even better, right?
Yeah, exactly. Someone who has expertise with roller derby. I know there are quite a few people actually who have familiarity with derby and also happen to be Objective-C and Swift coders. So I'm kind of hoping to see at least a skating sports. Exactly. Sure. Using the accelerometer too. Like there's a lot that you could do to make it a little more tuned to skaters, and not just roller derby, to skateboarding, to ice skating. Like there are a lot of to hockey. There are a lot of options here.
Yeah, that sounds fun. Hey, I actually have two tips to see. Let's see if you know either one of these. One I was really excited about. So when we're all crazy about the Fitbit, and you were, let's say your goal was 10,000 steps, and you were at 9,920, you'd run around your bedroom for those mm-hmm. last 80 steps, right, to get it over.
Yep.
So a little while ago, I had maybe like 8 calories left to burn before I got to the 700 I was trying to burn that day. And so I ran up and down the stairs like 20 times. I look at it, and it's like at 781. And then I figured out a trick. I put it in other, and I just did a plank. And it turns out your heart goes up really fast, and now it's measuring it quickly, right? Because you're in other, if you leave it in normal mode, it's not measuring your heart rate. It's only doing it every 10 minutes.
No,
if you put it in other, you can get up those last few calories and go to bed.
Yep. In general, when I'm trying to get my watch to actually recognize activity, I almost always log another workout. Like we were cleaning out the garage in the basement the other day, and I was just like, yep,
other.
Workout.
Yeah,
exactly. Otherwise, the watch is not going to understand
how hard this is.
Yeah, exactly. I'm carrying so much stuff.
I'm sweaty. It's got to be good. Well, yeah. No, that's a good, opens a new question. A lot of people, and Renee in particular, keeps talking about, oh, yeah, I go to bed with 50% left on my watch. Well, I work out a couple hours a day, and so does my husband. We go to bed like just barely limping it to get it onto the stand, and I'm thinking it's because we have it on workout so often.
Yeah, workout definitely drains the battery. Also, are you guys using 38s or 42 millimeters?
I have 38. He has 42. He doesn't work out quite as many minutes as I do in a day, but mine dies much faster.
Yeah, so the 38's battery is not significantly smaller than the 42, but by a decent, a noticeable margin. And I definitely have different readings than Renee does. I've, with the exception of running beta software, which I can't, I'm not going to say on because it's beta and I understand. Yeah. Yeah. But that when I was running the standard 101 on here, I would probably, especially after a derby, after a bout or after a scrimmage or after a practice, I would usually come back with 10% or so on my watch.
Yeah.
So it's not unusual, especially I was running, derby practices are 2 to 3 hours. So I was running 3 hour practices on my watch, right. And my watch was like, oh, help me. I need battery.
Limp it to the battery. Yeah,
exactly.
I burn through all my batteries on all my devices. I think I play with them too much.
Oh, but
The other one I found I think you might be interested in, you probably know this, but in case you don't, I would really love to be the one who got to tell you this. I was having trouble with my iPhone just out of the blue after 8.4, not immediately after 8.4. The battery just like, it was draining like it had a hole in it. And so I decided to reset my phone. So I did a backup and I figured, why use an iCloud backup when I've got my computer right here? I don't want to wait for it to come down from the cloud. I'll back up mm-hmm. to my computer and then I'll reload it. And when I reloaded it, all of my activity data from May 24th on was gone. I found out why.
Yeah.
Because my backup's not encrypted. And Apple won't share your health data unencrypted. And I thought that was brilliant. The good news of why that's brilliant is I happened to have an iCloud backup from that morning. So I restored to that backup and everything was fine. Did you already know that?
I did know that it wouldn't encrypt. But that is a great tip that we should write up on iMore because I don't think we have.
Yeah.
It's a very good point.
I think Apple should have told me. Would like the little pop-up saying, I'm not backing up your health data because that would leave it insecure. Mm-hmm. If you would like this backed up in the future, create an encrypted backup.
Yeah, please encrypt your backups.
Yeah, I think it should have told me that. But since it didn't, luckily I found somebody online said, oh, that's why I do iCloud. And when I saw there was one from that morning, still mad I lost my afternoon backup, or my afternoon workout. But instead of losing all that time, I was pretty excited.
Much better. Absolutely.
Yeah, very excited. All right, well, Serenity, I am so excited we got a chance to finally do this. This has been a lot of fun for me. What would you like to plug?
Oh, gosh. Well, iMore.com, we're working on even more Apple Music coverage. We're going to be working on some iOS 9 and OS 10 coverage coming very soon. Renee has access, of course, writable official access to the iOS 9 beta and OS 10 LCAP first look. So he's going to be answering some questions, talking about some of the new features that are coming out. We're going to have an ultimate guide, of course, when they officially drop in the fall. We're going to do more HomeKit stuff. I'm getting a chance to test out Elgato stuff as well as some other HomeKit products. And I'm very much looking forward to writing a HomeKit ultimate guide. So hopefully we can simplify it for users the world over who have questions similar to you.
Yay, I love it. And if people want to follow you, how would they do that other than going to imore.com every single day?
They can go to twitter.com. I'm there on at Setern, S-E-T-T-E-R-N, as well as on Instagram. And I do a podcast called The Incomparable with Jason Snell and a motley cast of characters on all topics, which you can find at The Incomparable.
Very good. Very good. Yeah. Jason told us about that when he was on the show. Excellent. Excellent. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Sounds like a plan. Take care, Allison.
Well, I hope you guys appreciated that new little music in between the two segments. You have no idea how long it took the chat room to make the decision on whether I played the regular chit-chat music before Bart or before Serenity, or I play it twice, or in the end, Steve won, which was two different kinds of music. So I guess Bart retains his position with the chit-chat music, and we have a new version of song in between. So that was very exciting for the live chat room. I'm sure they had a really good time. I had a good time with Serenity, and I sure hope she comes back soon. But that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsor for helping to pay the bills. Don't forget to go over to clarify-it.com, get yourself a free copy of Clarify, and try it out for however long they let you try it out for free, and then buy it. Anyway, don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, suggestions, especially because Alistair needs some recordings. Send in some recordings to me at allison@podfeet.com and follow me on Twitter @podfeet. Check out the new Silicast Google Plus community. I've been posting some stuff over there. A great picture of my daughter and I doing a great FaceTime session while I had her trying to fix her computer with me remote. It was really, really fun. If you want to join in the fun of the live show like Grim came back to after a long hiatus, head on over to podfeet.com/live, normally on Sunday nights, but remember, next week it's going to be Saturday at 3 p.m. Pacific time. And join the friendly and enthusiastic Nosilla Castaways. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.